opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Space is a place that only a human being locates, where there's so much information to take. Then you enter an entirely new phase. Once you get on the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary, on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Bowl.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
Arise and shine, beautiful people, arise. Arise in the light of God's wisdom. Beautiful people, arise. Your time has come. Beautiful people, arise. Free as your ancestors' vision. Go back to your old-time religion. Shine in the light of God's wisdom. Beautiful people, arise. The time has come. You must be true to yourself. You must learn to be about truth and take pursuit of that which is real. You gotta see what you can do about getting yourself together. If our nation should be strong, you gotta be prepared for any kind of weather. Your God, life is full of games. In mind that it is all the same. A voice within yourself begins your mind to think it fast. And then you see the glory of your past. Work and strive for that which lasts. Work and strive for that which lasts. Kings and queens arise. It's
You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind here on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton. I'm your host and facilitator. We started off today's program with a message in the music from Vanessa Rubin. Rise and shine, beautiful people, arise and shine. And that sets the stage for today's program and our guest, Kwabena Fahim Ashanti, who is an Afrocentric psychologist. He's an African priest, founder of the African Healers Association, an author of over 40 books, and he also is the author of the very controversial Willie Lynch letter, Making of a Slave. And we're going to speak with him following these messages, so don't go anywhere. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. We'd like to welcome everybody checking in from Real Media Player, from Windows Media Player, from iTunes. We want to encourage everyone to log into our website, which is blakeradio.com, and become familiar with how you can access our broadcast directly from our website. And vice versa, those of you who check in directly from the Blake Radio Network, become familiar with how you can also access us through Real Media Player, through Windows Media Player, and iTunes by logging into their radio tuner guides and doing a search for us in the talk radio genre. You're listening to Rainbow Soul, talk radio at its best. Junius Ricardo Stanton here with some truly great news. The Blake Radio Network has officially released the new Rainbow Soul iPhone and Android apps worldwide. Now, there is also an HTML version for all other cell phones. The apps can be accessed from www.blakeradio.com on the Rainbow Soul page or directly from the iPhone App Store or Android Market. These apps will allow you to lock in exclusively to the Rainbow Soul broadcast with the touch of a button. These acquisitions complete the development and release of all the apps for the Blake Radio Network family of channels, which includes Rainbow Soul, the All Talk channel, and Music Massage, an eclectic mix of R&B, jazz, soul, and reggae slow jams for your listening edification and entertainment. So take full advantage of this opportunity for connectivity and mobility by downloading your respective app from your source. Continue listening to the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul and Music Massage.
Gracious Professor Griff, you're listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griffin, Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
Our guest is Kwabena Fahim Ashanti. He's a licensed psychologist, Afrocentric psychologist. He's an African priest. He's the founder of the African Healers Association. He's written over 40 books. And he is a specialist on brainwashing and deprogramming techniques, and he's also the actual writer and author of the Willie Lynch letter, The Making of a Slave, and it's our pleasure to have him on the program. Welcome, brother. How are you?
Oh, it's indeed a pleasure to be with you, brother. I've been reading your work for a long time, and it's a real pleasure to meet you today.
Well, it's mutual. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Share some of your personal and professional background and development, and what brought you to the point where you're such a staunch warrior for African survival, African culture, and African redemption.
Well, my background, I'm from a little small town of about 3,000 people in Eastern North Carolina. I was born in 1944, so I'm 69 years old. I was raised by my grandparents and my grandfather, who was also known as a root doctor. By the way, he lived till he was 113 years old. So, and he was the first American on my paternal side born in America, because his father was brought here in 1857, and he was off that product. So that so he still has a number of African ways left in him. On my grandmama's side, they've been in since 1776. So make a long story short, he groomed me and raised me. I guess in many ways he programmed me, and I was not aware of it. But he told me he wanted me to be a doctor. And when I turned 12 years old, it was my grandma was a war over me, because at 12 years old in the South, that's the time you're supposed to be responsible for your sin. So she wanted to take me to church. Although my grandfather was also a preacher, Christian preacher, in quotes, but he wanted to give me my rights of passage. So he took me out in the woods, showed me all kind of traps and all kind of herbs and things like that. And I began to work with him as his helper until I turned probably about 18 years old. And I went off to college. I went to North Carolina Central University on a track scholarship. I was a 1962 North Carolina State champion in the high and low hurdles. So I went to North Carolina Central under the great Leroy Walker, who became the Olympic coach. And that's how I got to college. I had no intention of going to college, quite frankly. Nobody in my family had ever been. So one day I was working in this grocery store, and my coach came down to this man. He said, "You want to go to college?" I said, "Yeah, I was sure." Sure. And so that's how I ended up in college. And I graduated from there in 1966, and I got drafted, went to Vietnam, and in Vietnam I was a combat infantry soldier. And so when I came back to America, I said to myself, I probably would always catch hell from racists and white racists in America, but it would be on my terms from now on. So in 1963, I went to my grandfather. I said, "Tell me your father's name again." He told me, and I immediately changed my name at that time to Kwabena Fahim Ashanti. And then eventually I got the opportunity to go to Ghana, and I hooked up with my actual blood relatives.
Oh, really?
I also got my master's degree from North Carolina Central, and I got my doctorate. I started off at Harvard University, and I ended up at the University of Pittsburgh in 1974 with my PhD in counseling psychology.
Now, you were able to actually trace your lineage back to Ghana and actually found your blood relatives?
That's correct. In fact, I don't think my story is so unusual. It's just that I was on the quest and the search. Now, this is before DNA. So I had my grandfather made stools and in the tradition of Shanti way down in Chapel, North Carolina. And he practiced the things as a priest. And he told me some stories and so forth about these people. And he used the term Kromati and Ashanti. Neither of these things meant very much to me. But eventually when I went with a photograph and a picture and a recurring dream I had always had. That was being a very, very rich, powerful man, living way up on the top of a hill with a big house, with my own personal helicopter pad, and it being guarded by leopards. And And while I was there, I met this lady in Ghana who was kind of like an Oprah Winfrey type person in Ghana. And we talked and so forth, and I told her that I hope to find my people in Ghana. I said, I don't know much about it. I said, these are the words I have. These are the things I have. And I told her the story. And she said, what are you doing tomorrow? I told her. So next day, she came over and driving a big old white Mercedes with a man in the back of the car. And he got out of the car with this big umbrella. I've never seen anything like that. He turned out to be the Malapong Henny or the Shanti Henny, the most powerful king in all of Ghana. And it still didn't mean anything to me at that time, and I was asked to tell the story again. I told the story. One thing led to another, and I went to his house, and after we had lunch and dinner, I had a friend with me who was an attorney from Florida A&M. He said, do you want to go to see your people? You want to go to Kumasi? I said, sure. Well, these just words, they meant nothing to me. I thought it was maybe around the corner across town somewhere. Anyway, we got in the car, and I realized that we had been riding about an hour. And so I said, how far is this place? It was a 6.5-hour ride going up into the mountain. I got scared. And I need to call the people who I said, let them know where I am. And he said, they already know. I told them. And so I really got very, very apprehensive. But to make a long story short, after a 6.5-hour ride, I was in Kumasi, which is the capital of the Shanti territory. And they took me in, and I took them to the palace. The sign say, Ashanti Royal Silver Stool Palace. It was really exciting to see that. So I went in and had to tell my story again to a group of old men. And after questioning me and all this kind of stuff, I did not know that the leopard was the totem symbol of the Baricho Ashanti people. I had no idea. I was fascinated. And then they later showed me a section of land that was an epitome of the image of my dreams that I have been having. He said, that's yours. He gave it to me, just like that. And so later on, they came and grabbed me, scared me to death. I thought they were getting ready to beat me up, but they were lifting me up in the air. It turned out that I went over trying to be a conscious nigger. That's, you know, that's from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Left has been a sub-king among the Ashanti. And ever since, I've been going back and staying in touch and so forth. And eventually that led me into start getting interested in religion. I saw in religion a very powerful concept. So I came in and recreated an organization that has a precedent like that in all of Africa. All of them got it. So I created it here. So that's how that came about.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you a part of the, because here in this country, there's an association of African culture. I don't want to call them religion because it's really, you know, there's no such thing as religion in indigenous people's world. It's just part and parcel of the culture. It's not separate, something separate that they do. So are you part of that organization? And I forgot the name of it.
Not really. I'm familiar with the Akon group in New York City. I'm familiar with a group in Washington, D.C. That group was spurred and brought about by a gentleman called Dennis Zulu, who was an African-American. And he created it here, but my group is totally different. I mean, I happen to be one of those who got who was fortunate enough to have a grandfather who still had some traces of memory of what his father told him. So I didn't come that route at all.
Mm-hmm.
aware of them, but I'm not really a part of them, not at all.
Right. Okay. All right. Now, what do you do now? Are you a clinical psychologist? What are you affiliated with the university? I heard the other night that you give training. So what?
I just retired a year ago. I was a professor of I've been a professor of psychology at North Carolina Central, and I've been a counseling clinical psychologist at North Carolina State for almost 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just retired this past December.
That
and
is-
so what I do now is what I was doing on the side the whole time. Now I just got more time to put to it.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm a clinical psychologist. I see private patients. I'm a consultant on various things. I do speaking engagement. I've written, and I can say, 40 books. And I have, right now, I have 10 active mainstream books ranging from root work and voodoo and mental health to how to have an African funeral in Borough. I'm reintroducing African culture, if you will, through my writing back to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And let me see. I'm a specialist also in closing the academic achievement gap. And to that end, I created a systematic system to begin to analyze and define what was wrong with our students falling so far behind in academic and also being so overrepresented in the negative behavior. So in the process of doing that, I created a program for my college students. That's where I work, but I also do it for other groups too. But I made it almost like a fraternal system. And I recruited them, and I saw over 3,500 students in an average size group of 25 people each semester over 29 years. And I kept meticulous data. I got pre-death data before my program and after my program. And it has proven to be the most miraculous thing I've ever seen. I've gotten tremendous results. I've been featured on it in the New York Times, USA Today, a lot of black newspapers. I've gotten tremendous stuff. And if you look at a lot of the Afrocentric, I use AFRI, Afrocentric,
mm-hmm.
not Afro. I don't use that. I use African. And if you look at the most successful women in the country, they are based on my work directly or indirectly from my book called The Psychotechnology of Brainwashing.
All right. Now, we want to talk about that book shortly. You have a website. You have contact information. You have anywhere where people can go and buy your books using e-commerce. Like can they go up on the website and purchase it using PayPal or credit card or that type of arrangement?
Right now, no, but I will have it within a month. But you can go to put my name in on the internet, and you can go to a section. You can go to Barnes & Noble, the interface, and you can even go to a place called Serafina Books and see all of my work. And you can order it directly from me. I have it. But right now I'm getting a new website to be able to allow people to buy through PayPal and things like that.
Okay, now spell your name and give your other contact information, because you do speaking engagements, you do workshops, and you do book signing. So spell your name and then give us your contact information.
Okay, my name is Kwabena. That's spelled K-W-A. B as in boy, E-S-A, Fahim, F-A-H-E-E-M, and the last name is Ashanti, A-S-H-A-N-T-I. My telephone number is 919-452-4262, and my publishing company is Tone Books, T-O-N-E, Tone Books, 5119 Lansdowne Drive, L-A-N-S-D-O-W-N-E, Lansdowne Drive, Durham, D-U-R-H-A-M, North Carolina, just 27712.
All right, now we'll give you a chance to repeat that later on in the program in case people didn't have a pen at readily at hand. So you'll get several opportunities to repeat that. Now, one of the things that I was fascinated when I heard that you were the author of the Willie Lynch letter, The Making of a Slave. Now, I've been in many debates with people, and years ago there was a brother, a very erudite brother named Reggie Bryant, who was on the radio in Philadelphia. And he maintained that it was not authentic, and so there was a lot of controversy about that. And over the years, that's been my spin on it, is that, you know, I looked at it based on what Reggie was saying, looking at how the writing was for Anglo-Saxons back then. But that's immaterial as far as I'm concerned. My issue is, what were some of the motivations for you to write the letter? And number two, did you think it would have the effect that it had, or was that the outcome, was that the original intention for yourself?
Well, I actually wrote it in 1976. It was a two-page handwritten a letter. And it came about because I was in a study group of young professors and some community people. And we would meet once a week discussing various issues related to African and Black history. And there was no bookstore in Durham, North Carolina, dealing with Black stuff. So we said, we need to have a bookstore. So we created a bookstore, and one of the guys out of the group named, I forgot his name right now, but he created the no bookstore in Durham. And I used a hand crank duplicator and ran off probably about two or 300 copies of this letter, and at 12 o'clock at midnight, I got in my car, and I just rode all over Durham, putting in washettes, car washes, anywhere people would come, hoping that they would see it and read it. And I was very careful to not let people see me putting it in there where it put it, because that's why I went out at 12 o'clock at night. I didn't tell anybody in the study group that I did it either, because I was trying to create a deep awareness that something needed to be done. And I thought if they read that, they would become so angry about it that they'd begin to start discussing it and start reading more stuff on our history. That was my intent. And the original letter spread it somehow. And I had forgotten all about it. And lo and behold, when I went to the Million Man March, Minister Louis Farrakhan read it. And when he read it, it hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, that's my stuff. And what had happened was different people somewhere began to add to it and modify it and change and add to it, because I was not a very good fellow, still am not. And my grandma and so forth was not the best in the world, but the thought was there. So ultimately, it came out in a book. And then I became very much aware that it seemed to be taking on a life of its own. This was before I wrote my book, The Psychotechnology of Brainwashing, Who's a Fan with It. This was about 10 years before I wrote my book. And I had no intention whatsoever, and never did I ever think it would grow to become what it was. Over the years, I began to hear other people talking about it, especially after the book came out and after the Million Man March. And I would listen to the same they would say. And it looked like to me, they began, when they read it, it's like they found the Holy Grail. It's like they found the answer, so they don't have to read no more at all. They said, this is why I'm blah, blah, blah. And they kind of irritated me, but at the same time, I was not about to come out and say I did it because I didn't want people really to turn on me and all that kind of stuff. So, make a long story short, there is a movie that came out, and I would highly recommend anybody see it if you want to see the winner of this letter. It's called Sankofa, S-A-N-K-O-F-A. A lot of people say Sankofa, Sankofa. That's the name of the movie about Holly Jarema.
Yeah, Holly Jarema. Right. Mm-hmm.
I actually met him, and we talked. I told him his movie, almost verbatim, was coming straight down what was written in the Winner's Letter. I didn't tell him I had written it. And to this day, it's the only thing that's still close to that. But I never dreamed that letter would become all of that. And when I looked to see that it was put out by a black distributor firm up in New York, it was no copyright, nothing in it. And so, it didn't mean that much to me. It was just, I'm an ex-military person. So using clandestine communication media, I mean, that's biggest routine for people who go, I've had that training, you see. So it didn't really mean that much to me. And it still don't right now. But if people want to understand how it was done, how to undo it, they need to get a copy of my book called The Psychotechnology of Brainwashing. And now I've changed it to say Psychotechnology of Brainwashing, Hitler's and Lingering Consequences of Ancestor Enslavement. I've taken the Crucified Witness title off the bottom of it now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now that's the title of the book. Give us your contact information. And also, can you give us the ISBN number? So, because if people want to order it from Barnes & Noble or...
can order through them, and they would send it to me. The ISBN, the name of the book is Psychotechnology of Brainwashing, Healing the Lingering Consequences of Ancestor Enslavement. The publishing company is Tone Books, T-O-N-E. And the ISBN number is 0-911-325-05-0. And it is carried in all the major carriers. They once was carrying it, and it was in all the black bookstores, but I completely sold out. And over the years, they couldn't get it, so they would tell say, no, it's out of print, it's out of business, but it's not. It's coming back out now.
Okay. Give the contact information for Tone Press or where people can order it from directly from you.
Directly, you will write to Tone Books, 5119 Lansdowne Drive, Lansdowne, Durham, Durham, North Carolina, 27712. The cost of the book now is, it was originally, that book was $25. Now, the cost of it now is $59.95.
Okay.
Only, if you go to Amazon.com, if you can find it, you will see that they are charging $450 for a used copy.
Wow. What's the difference? Why the diversity?
Because I published it myself. I never had a whole lot of copies. And with such and so demand, that's why people start selling them like that. They would buy it for me for $25 and put it up to Barnes and Noble and then start selling for that.
Mm-hmm.
My bookwork and voodoo book, by the way, which I got a lot of criticism for even writing it in the first place and laughing and joking at me, all now sells for $1,000 per copy if you can get it.
Wow. That's the voodoo and mental health or the root work?
And both of them now is coming back out again, and so therefore I've raised the price on my own book, but nothing like what they're charging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, as a psychologist,
also there's a workbook with the psychotechnology of brainwashing. The training that I do, I have a training workshop manual to go with that for those who want to do training with a group of people.
All right, well, how do people get in contact with you to be trained to be a trainer?
Let me give you, first of all, let me give you my email address. My email address is Kwabena, K-W-A-B-E-N-A, underscore, A as in Apple, 2000, at yahoo.com. And then they can call me directly at Erica 919-452-4262. And I will be glad to come to your city, wherever you are, to train a group of people or to train you by long distance in this process.
All right, we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but I just want to get into the African Healers Association. Tell us about that, and what's the how do you put forward your techniques and ideas about healing? Because from my perspective, you know, they say it takes a village to raise a child, but in our particular situation, the village is very, very ill. So how do we heal ourselves?
Well, what I did was, once I put the concept together, I talked to a lot of people I respected. One of them is Dr. I can't think. He was with protege of Dr. Joe, who did the carbon dating on the.
Oh yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, I know. Phil Banger.
Yeah. And he insisted that I should put in the title thinkers too. So it's the International Association of African Priests, Healers, Thinkers, and Religion Incorporated. So once I did that, then I know I needed to get the very best impeccable people I can find out here to be on the board. So I wrote up the concept, then I mailed it to various people from many different denominations, if you will, of African traditional religion or spirituality, as you say. And that ranged from ancient committed religion, Abosong, a religion of the Akan people of Ghana,
mm-hmm.
Orisha, the people of Nigeria,
right?
The religion of the people of the Zulu in South Africa, just a number of these subjects, and then I created a terminology for the religion itself to be equivalent to Christianity with its many denominations and Islam with its many denominations. So I created Fatara Set as a religion with all these verse, other like Voodoo, Orisha, and so forth as denominations of Fatara Set. And I wanted only priests of those things. And to be considered, you have to have, I would go on the internet looking for people who had written books on the subject, written papers on the subject, or were practitioners. And I contacted them, and I was fortunate in getting almost everyone that I wanted. And one requirement is to be on my board and to be a leader in this, you had to have had an African name. That's the first criteria.
Mm-hmm.
There were many healers who had still Christian names, okay, and who were experts in what they did, but they could be a member of the association but not on the board. So then I went after thinkers. The thinkers were people who, like yourself, who were not priests and so forth, but were very, very deep thinkers. So I had that division. Then I have a lot of different divisions. Another division was just the arts and music, both drummers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Another one was in science. I had a lot of different divisions. And I then put together the first national convention of it. I think it was in I think it was in 2001, I think, I'm not certain. And there were about 300 people who came from all over the place. And we, I filmed all these things, by the way, but it's never been seen by anybody. I couldn't probably just have the original to take some. And we had an area, so we've had nine conventions, and we got one coming up. We're hoping to try to put it together in Philadelphia. We differ from many other groups because our requirements are pretty stringent. You got hustlers and you got pretenders and everything. I don't care what it is.
Right.
So,
right.
So no difference. So I did the best I could to weed all that out. And in some cases, there was a gentleman who's a well known Yoruba priest in I think Philadelphia. And I invited him to join, and one of the requirements was that you cannot be gay, and you cannot advocate that. And so when he joined, he came in with that understanding. And then later on, come to find out, he and his organization, he had a number of gays, and some of them, he was trained to be priests. And when I found that out, then my board ordered me, told a question of me to excommunicate them from my group, and I did. And then I was attacked nationally from
right.
all different kind of
right.
people
right.
with that.
Right.
And so if it's not African, we don't do it. Now let me point this out. I don't practice African culture myself, and I don't advocate anybody do. The reason I say that is pure African culture was what they were practicing when they sold us to the white man to come over here and trade. So I don't want no possibility that repeat happen again. So I practice what is known as the Afrocentric culture. That is taking the best they have to offer and applying a political test to it, keeping that part was good and getting rid of that which I consider detrimental.
Well, I think for us, that's the approach we have to take, because circumstances, the environment, the politics, everything is different from what our ancestors practiced or did. And my understanding of culture is a combination of your mores, your folkways, your norms, your values, all of that. So
that's true.
And what's happened is we have, particularly in the last 50 years or 45 years, we have internalized more of the European values than, you know, holding on to the remnants of the African values. And we can look at the pathology in our community, and this is my perspective on it. We can look at the pathology in our community, and that's the direct result of us internalizing those values of the Europeans, in addition to their very covert and sometimes the overt policies of genocide and minicide against us. And so we find ourselves in a situation where we have to be the ones to heal ourselves, because their system of healing, I mean, they can't even heal themselves. So, you know, why would we turn to them for healing? So we have to take the best of what it means to be African and apply it in today's reality and forge a new reality for ourselves.
Yes. Let me give you one example. One part of African culture and the spirituality is that the gods can live and be in everything.
Right.
And so therefore you treat everybody with love, respect, and inclusion, because you don't know who you're talking to.
Well,
that opens the door to the wolf to come in, and by the time you find out he's a wolf, it's too late. So I made a transformation of African culture where we apply that only to another African, but never another race.
Well, that might solve it. I think our conundrum as first world people, whether they were in Africa, whether they were in the Pacific, whether they were in North and South America, we applied that because we understood that the creative spirit was in everything. And when we saw it, and
we still have that, but I'm saying,
I know
when you put in today's technological society, you have to play by the rules of power. Okay? So therefore, if you go to Europe right now, you will be questioned until they find you all right and be accepted. Go to Africa and they'll open you a
I agree with you, and I agree with the African principle, and I was just explaining our conundrum of first world people. We were not xenophobic like the European. We were xenophilia, where we were open and receptive. We helped them. We saw how pitiful they were, and that has been our undoing, because they came, and even when they attempted to come as non-threatening, they introduced pathogens into our environment, like alcohol, lying, stealing, all that kind of stuff. And I say all that to say, you know, to agree with you, it's just in our nature, it's going to be hard for us to be really discerning and discriminatory, because we intuitively sense the creator in everything. So let me ask you, how do you do that, given under normal circumstances? And obviously we don't live in normal circumstances because we have been totally brainwashed. But under normal circumstances, seeing the politics of that you're talking about, how do we get to that position where you're talking about, where we close down that xenophilia that we intuitively and normally would have?
Yes. The way I do it is that the first thing I do is point out racial cultural differences, okay? And I point out at first time we saw it displayed toward us. For example, I go back to ancient Kemet itself before it became Egypt. That humanitarian disease, I call it, that we have, we was extending it to the Greeks. Now, our native people in the country now called Egypt, you know, called Kemet, now are the servants of those white Arabs there now. Okay?
Right.
When you explain this, then you say, okay, this is how you deal with it. This is the first sign. Just because it's a sign does not mean that it exists. But you have to be aware of it. And so, therefore, when you talk, when you give tours or whatever, you should be conscious all the time to be careful with this person until they are proven innocent. Then, though, and we have to stop opening and giving the keys to the vault first and then cry later. That's the way I've been able to do it. And it has worked very well with the people I've trained. Now, once you prove that you are acceptable, and therefore you can respect them and they can respect you, you see, and you can be very good friends with them. It's not a racist concept at all. It is a self-defense that comes with establishing your centrality. All races who have power have a centrality about them, meaning their own culture, all these things. We are the only ones in America that don't have it. And in Africa, because of the westernization and the explosion of Christianity, it has made it worse to the day to where Obama now has troops, United States troops, in 32 of these African countries south of the Sahara, and now has a missile base already built in Mali and in Niger. And he said to get Al-Qaeda. Well, I would never trust that. Never would trust that.
Well, but so, you got to remember, to their credit, when Bush attempted to have AFRICOM there, they rejected it.
So yeah, look at where we are now.
Oh yeah, but we have to understand how they did it. They Al-Qaeda is not a real entity. It's a bogus, fake entity that they use as a pretext and justification to go in and quote-unquote intervene wherever they want, whether it's Africa, Asia, whatever. And so,
because if they had your mentality, then we wouldn't be there now. They don't have your mentality to be able to see what I'm saying. You're saying what I'm saying.
Right. But I'm just putting out there that they put pressure on the strong, whatever you thought of Gaddafi, he was attempting to unite the Africans and to make the Africans stronger economically and politically, and he was underwriting a lot of their projects, which was taking money away from the World Bank, the IMF, and USAID. And he was talking about having a gold-backed African currency. So you know he had to go from the white boy's perspective.
Yes, no question.
And so what we're seeing now in some elements, now obviously they're after the gold and uranium in Niger and Mali, but they're also wanted to follow up on what they did in Libya. So
No doubt.
So I say all this to say, you know, we have to, like you say, look at their behavior, look at their culture, which they've been doing to themselves for thousands and thousands of years before they unleashed it on the rest of the world, and just wake up. So my question to you is, how do you take this to wake us up? Because people see that, and cognitive, they can say, yeah, that makes sense. Some of them, most of them are so brainwashed, they just love Obama. They can't see him for what he's doing. So how do you wake people up? I mean, that's the quintessential question of today.
Okay. There are, I'm going to name some key principles to be able to brainwash anybody and to reprogram them. There's fear. That's the correct, proper knowledge.
Right.
And with those things, you build it into the training process itself. So here's a short version of what I'm saying is you know your enemy, do research, study, and never let your fear stop you from doing what you need to do. In the African religious tradition, you don't die a physical.
Right,
you only
die
of physical death,
right,
but
right.
You still live on spiritually. That's one of the principles the Zulu and the Ashanti used with colonialism. The Zulu were never colonized, and the Ashanti were never colonized, okay? Because they fought to the death, but they still live on. And so, therefore, the European left them alone and tried, and then began to colonize other people and allow them, even in Ghana, even in South Africa, you had independent nations within a nation,
right. So, well, that was the same thing that happened in the Americas with the Quilombos and the Maroons. The key to it, and I know you know it, but I'm trying to get you to articulate it, those of us who retain the most of their African tradition, and Bukman and all those people in Haiti and the Quilombos and the Maroons who maintain their African spirituality, which understood that they're part of the immortal process, they rumbled and defeated all of them, whether it was the British, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the French, you name it. And so, to me, that's the key. And I heard you.
I am simply doing the same thing that they did, make corrections into our culture. That's mm-hmm. what Bookman and them did.
Right.
Yeah. Now, you with me there.
Yeah. No question. I just wanted you to articulate it because you're the one who has written the book, The Psychotechnology of Brainwashing. And also,
there's a recipe of a 9 major steps within the process, okay? And within that process, you make space to put in, let's say, offenses and defensive tactics, mental tactics, you see? And then you begin to teach that tactics where they can see it and give them examples of where it works and so forth and so on, and then gradually start incorporating it. Because naturally, we are humanitarian people, naturally. But that is a... That don't mean that it's universal. It don't have to mean that. It means be loyal to your family first.
Right.
And if you have anything left over to help somebody, you do. But otherwise, stay at home. For example, you hear many of our speakers when they're advocating on behalf of black people, they can't stay at home and save their life. They got to always talk about our Hispanic brothers, our Mexican brothers. They're Mexican. I know some of the Mexican people. Now, they are. According to the research has shown that they, overall, they are more prejudiced toward African people or black people than the white person are. They don't relate to white people, but white people don't relate to the Mexicans. When I say Mexican, I mean all of those people called Mexican who might come from Honduras or wherever they may come from. That's what the research has shown.
Yeah, well,
but with me, I interact with a lot of them, okay? And they don't see me as being the typical African-American because I wear African clothes, beads, I practice my African culture, everything. And they are amazed when they see me. So we can talk almost like we're brothers. And they will talk about us like a dog, them like a dog, don't recognize that I'm one of them too, but they keep me separate from that because they admire. I've got admiration, by the way, from almost every race I've ever seen. I get big time admiration from whites, Mexicans, any of them, because, and Hindus, I've even been given all free office space by Hindus who by nature don't relate to American black.
Yeah.
And because I practice my stuff, and then I respect them, and they respect me back.
Well, but they also see what is missing, for the most part, is that warrior mentality. Yes, we're xenophilic. Yes, we are embracing and open, but we also recognize that there's a time to defend ourselves and even a time to go on the offensive. And so they sense that in you. That's why they respect you.
They see it and so forth. When I write a check, the minute the Arabs say, "Where's this bank?" I said, "That's a black bank." "Oh, really?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I put my money in with my people. Don't you put it with your people?" "Yeah, we get along fine." How do I be worried about what they do? They don't be worried about what the hell I do. They just hope that here what I do don't spread to them,
because
it will no longer be used anymore.
Right. All right. Now we're closing out on the time on this segment. Number one, I'd like a commitment that you'll come back in numerous times, and also number one, number two, I have a question. Do you have any media like CDs, DVDs, the films of the lectures that you can also sell or post on your website when you get it up?
I have masters of many things, but I have not reproduced them or so, but I have them in a condition that where they can be, okay, ranging from videotapes to audio tapes of where I've spoken and various things like that. I have the masters, but they have to be reproduced to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
And that's another way of spreading the word much quicker.
Right. Is there any plans in the future to do that? Are there any plans?
Yes, sir. It certainly is. No question about it. Because I have a small, for lack of a better word, prison ministry, okay? And so I've never seen these people. So they want my material. And I have to go through the chaplains and the superintendents and get permission to say this is not subversive stuff.
Right.
So therefore, that's what I use to send to them.
Okay, well, give us, we didn't really get a chance to talk about specifics in the book, Psychotechnology of Brainwashing. But give us your contact information so people can buy it on their own and read it for themselves, because the best knowledge is self-knowledge, and the best education is self-education.
Thank you so much. The people who will get my book with the first, and the first in line, is you write directly to me on my email or call my number at area code 919-452-4262. Or call my email or write me an email letter at Kwabena, kwabena_a2000@yahoo.com. And hit me directly that way, and I'll make sure you get my books and any material that I have first. The cost of it is $59.95 for the book. And the different tapes, the average cost for the tape is around $10. So,
all right, now, excuse me.
I'm sure you get it.
Okay,
and
now.
And anybody who just want to talk to me in general, some advice or training, I welcome your calls at any time.
All right, now, does that price include shipping and handling and postage?
Oh, no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. That you probably should add probably about another $5 for the shipping and handling. First class, I send stuff first class mail.
Okay, so now you're talking about $55, $56, right?
No, the book itself is $59.95.
Oh, okay. So I'm sorry. So you're talking now about $66, right?
Yes, sir. That's
okay.
Correct. Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. So if you want a copy of the book, and it's coming out, it's being republished as we speak.
Right.
And so, and it'll probably be about $66, including shipping, handling, postage. And so give us the address again so they can order it and your phone number, and then we'll let you go. But you got to give me a promise that you come back.
I promise you will. I enjoyed doing this. I know this is vital and it's necessary. Because it takes a group of people to be able to do systematic planning and spreading the word. My address is 5119 Lansdowne Drive, LANSDOWNE Drive, DRIVE, Durham, DURHAM, North Carolina, zip code 27712. And I look forward to working with you extensively to do whatever's necessary.
Okay, now give us your phone number again.
Area code 919-452-4262.
All right, now I want you to stay on the line because I want to talk to you about something as we transition into the next segment. So don't go anywhere, and then we'll come back with follow up with the next segment of the program.
Diverse faith is a faith that no army with artillery can beat, where no military.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates, no denomination faith dominates, and no court is going to try it.